Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grainne Reid, your host for today, and I'll be joined by Head of Content at ExchangeWire, John Still. How are you, John?
I'm good, thanks. I'm delighted to welcome you to the podcast. Welcome making your debut today.
I know. Yeah, exciting. Joining John is also ExchangeWire's research lead, Matt Broughton. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Grainne. A pleasure to be here. And yes, similarly honoured to be part of your podcast debut.
Thanks so much. Yeah, very exciting. Well, on today's episode, as always, we'll be diving into three news stories of the week. We'll be covering the Make a Fair campaign that we saw splashed across UK newspapers this week, YouTube falling into the TV bracket, as well as discussing ExchangeWire's Media Pulse report, which launched on Tuesday. So first up, let's discuss the creative industry's protest against the UK plan about AI and copyright. Thousands of British creatives, musicians, artists, authors, and journalists are protesting against government proposals that could allow tech firms to use their work to train AI. As the consultation on copyright rules ends on Tuesday, the industry has launched the Make a Fair campaign, warning that an opt-out system threatens creative rights and fairness. This campaign highlights the concerns that an opt-out system could undermine the value of creative work and potentially lead to exploitation by tech firms. John, let's go to you first. Do you think the Make a Fair campaign will have a significant impact on the proposed AI copyright rules?
I really hope so, as a first point. I was really, really happy to see, you know, the splash across all the different publications, everyone working as one here, because it's, for want of a better word, this is a mess that the government have made with this proposed regulation. It is a shame that they've seem fit to pursue this route, really. I know that we want to boost AI in the UK and they want to offer some sort of home base and platform for AI in Europe, being the UK. But the way they've gone about it with this potential opt-out system is, it seems detrimental to pretty much every industry across the board. It seems like it has made an impact initially, which is great. There was news yesterday came out that the government is, after the protest that we saw with, first of all, Make It Fair in the papers, and then the silent song with 1,000 artists gathering to protest the impact on the music industry, that they are already considering making changes to the proposed rules. But I really hope it's enough to make not only the government sit back and think about these proposals, but also, bring it more into the public consciousness about what the impact of these models really can be.
Yeah, 100%. And just touching on those musicians, we saw artists like Kate Bush, Hans Zimmer, they released the silent protest album titled Is This What We Want? To highlight the concerns about the AI potentially replacing human artists. Matt, how do you think these AI rules will impact the future of creative expression and the livelihood of these artists?
Yeah, I think in terms of, just to echo what John was saying, in terms of the proposals as they stand, they're, you know, really illogical, unworkable, and they're damaging to the creative industry. So to have that opt-out system, I think it's the only benefit that has is to either, if you're a US AI scraping company or a middleman looking to take a fee for managing what's likely to be a really onerous process of managing opt-outs for individual authors, artists, publishers, etc. I think a opt-out system is absolute nonsense, and it kind of spits in the face of the creative industry. If you write a book and it's published, you expect to be paid for your wordcraft. If you record a song, you expect to be paid for your musical skill. If you write an article, you expect to receive revenue, whether it's in the form of sponsorship, advertising, subscription, you expect to see revenue for that. And having an opt-out, you know, having to opt out of having that your work scraped, crudely amalgamated into a slightly tweaked version and then profited upon is just absolute nonsense. And frankly, I'd be tempted to turn up to the lawmakers' houses with a bag of swag and a stripy top and say, you know, you haven't actively opted out of having your house burgled. Where's the silver? It's just tone deaf from the government. And I think in terms of how the proposals were initially run, it looks as if it's decided it should be growth above all else, without realizing that the only beneficiary of that growth is, you know, US companies built on intellectual property theft and tax dodging rather than the talented and skilled creators in the UK, which actually pay their fair way. So, yeah, I'm very not on the fence that the system should be opt-in. And it just gives a much cleaner and clearly enforceable signal to the AI companies, either pay creators for their content or you're legally culpable if you steal it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. John, like, what do you think the benefits of an opt-out system will be?
I think Matt's just covered it, really. He's used a wonderful analogy. Yeah, mine would be, you know, it's blaming the victim of a robbery for not locking their house properly. It's a way for the tech companies to shirk responsibility and shift the responsibility entirely onto the creative owner. It's not workable, you know, it is interesting as a proposal, but it just shifts the onus onto the wrong area of the industry entirely for me. I'm just reading through some of the things they're looking at in light of the protest and changes might be, and this one's really caught my eye, is that officials are looking for ways to offer the creative industries extra protections. One could be to allow creative industries to opt into the new system while offering AI companies the use of mass media such as journalism for free unless they opt out, which is absolutely baffling. That it's like, okay, so Elton John's protested, so we'll cover the music industry, but yeah, the journalism can be thrown to the wolves. No, it has to be, you know, we are all creative industries in the media as well as musicians, and everyone needs to be protected. And yeah, for me, the opt-out system was a cop-out. It was a way of throwing everyone's work to the wolves and then blaming them for not protecting themselves enough. But I believe strongly in these protests and I will back them to the hilt.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a lot to watch here in this space. Let's see what happens. But in the meantime, let's avoid getting any balaclavas and going to rob any people's houses.
Agreed. Swag bags galore.
Well, I think we can maybe move on to our next story, which will look at YouTube and whether it is now to be considered TV. So Barb is incorporating viewing of YouTube channels into an expanded measurement initiative for YouTube content viewed on TV sets in what the Joint Industry Currency, or JIC, always claims is a world first. So in partnership with CViews, which specialises in planning ad campaigns on YouTube, Barb is selecting 200 channels that will become part of its daily audience reporting on the platform. Meanwhile, YouTube has also announced a lower price version of its paid tier. So John, do you think this is the final step in YouTube being considered a legitimate TV contender?
Yeah, yes, that's a very short answer. Like, we've had a lot of discussions around streaming TV and TV over the past year, and one of the questions that's always thrown up is YouTube TV? Is, you know, do we measure this in the same way? And I think the tipping point was last month when YouTube was watched on TV screens for the first time more than it is on mobile screens. And that was sort of like, that's a watershed moment. And now with Barb being involved and choosing these 200 channels from YouTube to be kind of legitimately measured in the same way that the other television is. Yeah, it's absolutely like we are now in the world of YouTube. It is a TV channel. It is a top contender for ad spend on a TV channel. And yeah, it will be, you know, it's an interesting situation now to see how people respond, because YouTube is kind of this all-encompassing beast that competes with everyone. It competes in the gaming sphere. It competes on the mobile screen. It competes for short-form content. And now it is going to be, yeah, a go-to TV channel. So I do think this is a bit of a watershed moment in putting the "is YouTube TV" conversation to bed.
Matt, what are your thoughts on it? And would you consume TV through YouTube?
So I agree with John in the sense that I think, you know, YouTube's been TV for a while, but obviously, as he referenced, that watershed moment when it's been in the US, watch more on a TV screen compared to mobile. Personally, I don't tend to watch it on a TV screen, but I think that's just my general viewing habits in terms of what I watch on YouTube. It's more in that kind of buried long tail side of things rather than a Mr. Beast or one of the larger channels, which are probably more suited to that TV viewing. And I think if you look at what TV is and what YouTube is, it's kind of, oh yeah, it probably has been TV for a while, in the sense that it broadcasts live events, it's broadcast live sports events for years and years, and production companies and other channels either sell or upload full version content to YouTube the world over. So it's a little bit of a surprise that it's taken this long to actually bring TV measurement bodies to the table in terms of YouTube in that daily audience reporting sense. I really like how Barb's approaching it, and I think it's a very logical first step in terms of monitoring those 200 channels which are most likely to be viewed on the TV screen. And it's quite an impressive scale as it is in that, in the sense that it's quite similar to the scale of Samsung Plus UK in terms of that number of channels. But as I referenced, that long tail is far, far greater in YouTube. So I'd expect to see the number of channels gradually brought up, say like 500 to 1,000, just to really capture that international long tail. But yeah, I really like their approach that they've adopted so far.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I believe it'll be Q3 before we see any reporting on this. But yeah, I guess it will be something to keep an eye on. Just when we kind of touched on the lower pricing version of YouTube being released, do you think this is going to lead to a shift in viewership dynamics and audience engagements, Matt?
I think it's always good to, you know, have those different levels of tariff subscription. Whether it not has a real practical effect, I'm not entirely sure personally. Like I said, I don't necessarily view it on the TV screens. But yeah, I think having the additional options, especially if they then go and decide actually we want to raise the more premium subscription tier. I know that's obviously an approach that's been run by a lot of the streamers, obviously Amazon Prime and Netflix as examples, and Disney Plus as well. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it did have an effect in terms of, you know, bringing more users onto that mid-level tier.
Yeah. And John, what are your thoughts on the lower price version that YouTube are offering?
Yeah, I think it's another step to helping it compete in the area. You know, we've seen Netflix, Disney, Amazon all moved into their ad-supported tiers and bringing in lower and free tiers. And it's just another strike for YouTube to go in the same direction and legitimize itself as an actual TV providing service. I agree, Matt. It's not the way I use YouTube. Mine's mainly for DIY tutorials that I watch on my phone while drilling a hole in the wrong wall or something. But it's like, I can see its use, and I can see its partnerships with major broadcasters is going to push it really in the direction of a legitimate TV kind of experience. We know Channel 4 have had great success from off-platforming their stuff onto YouTube. I think they had 159% growth in their views on YouTube. I'm going to have to check those stats before we publish. But it has had huge success with its YouTube channel and off-platforming. So yeah, I think as that stuff takes hold, it will be, it's not a surprise to see lower price tiers come in to try and make a paid for experience more attractive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And John, can a JIC help the TV and streaming ad ecosystem thrive? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. At the back end of last year, start of this year, we did a couple of panels on the future of TV and where we were with the CTV and streaming industry at the moment. And one of the major questions was about this standardization. And it's a very fragmented ecosystem. There's a lot of different experiences out there. And having, yeah, stuff like joint industry currencies, standardization and measurement is a way of assuring advertisers of what they're getting, of the quality they're receiving, and the reach that they can ultimately get. So I think that's, yeah, as it grows and the audience for it grows, for advertisers to really know what they're getting into, the standardization, joint industry currencies will really, really help that, having reliable measurement. So yeah, advertisers know where they stand. I think it can only reinforce the strength of where CTV and streaming is going.
Matt, are you of the same opinion there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that fragmentation across CTV is such a significant issue to the industry. And to kind of give a pre-promotional plug, we've got an exciting report coming out in March with Rakuten Advertising as to the scale of that problem. And it's absolutely huge. And yeah, to bring that standardization across measurement can only be a good thing. To use an analogy, remember the time when every single mobile phone had just a slightly different charger. So you had to kind of rummage around to try and find the correct one. Otherwise, you'd have to buy a completely new one. Having one consistent charger, or in this case, measurement system, just helps eliminate or at least reduce some of those pain points. Not that, you know, JICs are infallible and they should continue to be scrutinized, but yeah, they do reduce a lot of that headache. And having that consistency can reduce errors. Obviously, there's the flashback to Nielsen losing its MRC accreditation during the pandemic due to underreporting some TV channels and shows. And obviously, in terms of if it's a more kind of hidden metric as employed by the walled gardens, they can be gained. An example, I think there's no doubt in the next earnings report that Google releases, it's going to shout about how its Gemini AI has been used across the workspace. Millions and billions of people are using it, but that's only because it rams it down your throat every single time you open an email, open a doc. It's just like, do you want AI's help with that? It's like, no, I can know how to say, hi, this is an email. But yes, so having these consistent metrics can only be a good thing.
Amazing.
I've just gone back. Sorry, Ronnie. I've just gone back and checked those stats so we can publish. And it's 169% year-on-year, the growth in Channel 4's reach on YouTube. I'd done them wrong by 10%. So just to confirm.
Thanks for clarifying that. Way more impressive figure than you first thought.
Than even imagined. Who'd have thought?
No, it's exciting, some interesting stuff going on. And I know TV for us anyway at ExchangeWire is something that we're going to keep a close eye on for 2025. Well, let's move on to our final story of the week. And it's backed with positivity for the industry and views that marketers will increase their budgets. So we're going to discuss figures from the latest ExchangeWire Media Pulse report, which is based on H2 2024 findings. Within this report, it showed that 89% of surveyed readers planned increases or saw plans to increase client budgets for this year, making a huge uplift in optimism from earlier in 2024. So Matt, to you, are there reasons to be cheerful for marketers?
Yeah, I think there are definitely reasons to be cheerful for marketers, and that extent of uplift in optimism is absolutely huge. And it's surprising that, we polled our readers at the start of the half last year, and it was just after one of the IPA bellwether reports, which had recorded, record growth. And they're a bit like, okay, it's not necessarily going to grow that much. Fast forward to December, and it's like, whoa, 89% uplifting their budgets. And it, just goes to show that optimism is there within the industry. And I think those, growth in areas such as retail media, curation, CTV, and also digital out of home, I think that's what's going to be driving those budget increases. That's not to say that, there aren't headwinds and they do remain. Obviously, we still got the channel of signal loss. Physical retail is seeing a loss and, stagnant footfall. And there's uncertainty within the global political climate. But that such a high proportion, that 89% of industry respondents increasing their budgets or either seeing their clients increase their budgets, it's just such a positive indicator that marketers truly believe that those headwinds can be weathered.
Yeah. John, anything to add to that?
No, it was really nice to see. We're all happy with our Media Pulse report, and it's actually really nice to be able to come on the podcast and talk about something that we have done that's, akin to IPA bellwether and, to talk about stats we've put together. So first of all, delighted with that, a little plug for us. But it's good to see that positivity. We've had there's been not negative, but very cautious couple of years. I think caution's been the byword for each quarter for the past couple of years. And we've been waiting and waiting for a turn. And it was really nice to see that the year started with that kind of that big, big bump in positivity. And that's, we're hoping to see that last throughout the year. We'll be back in with the H1 report for this year in a few months' time. So I echo Matt's sentiments. It is positive to see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just gives a nice bump to the start of 2025. Measurement was one of the areas that the report focused on, and more specifically, confidence with ad measurement. A poll assessed whether media and marketing professionals were becoming more confident in their advertising measurement or whether challenges were preventing accurate assessment of their campaign performance. There were 59% of respondents said they were highly confident with measuring their advertising campaigns, claiming previous challenges have eased. However, nearly one-fifth of these surveyed are still encountering significant challenges with accurately measuring their campaign performance. What are your thoughts on these measurement figures, and what factors do you think have contributed to the increased confidence? John, what are your thoughts?
Again, it's like it's an interesting number. Measurement is something we talk about an awful lot, and we're looking at different ways of measuring and how success is quantified. But it's great to see that people are positive regarding how that's changed and that there has been a real development in it. Almost 60%. It's a really nice chunk of people who are happy with the results they're getting and that they are being measured properly. So there, that's a lot higher than I imagined it would be, to be honest. I'd expected a bit of an inversion there. I thought we might have been seeing people certainly towards the less confident end of the spectrum. Nice to see, and proof that the industry is moving in the right direction.
Yeah, it's absolutely a higher number than I would have thought too. Matt, anything to add to that?
Not really, in terms of obviously how confident people are with measurement. Obviously, it's been years since we were supposed to have the deprecation of the third-party cookie, so it's not too surprising that the industry has been, you know, working towards alternative measurement systems, or ones that, you know, still incorporate the cookie to a lesser extent to, you know, account for users' choice. How much that confidence will change as and when Google does part deprecate the cookie by moving it fully towards that user choice, I think that remains to be seen. And I think, yeah, it's definitely a huge, you know, kudos to the industry that so many are confident with their measurement now. But, you know, 20% still uncomfortable with their measurement, I think that's something that we still need to address, particularly when we've got that looming signal loss coming in.
Yeah. No, I know. And Matt, obviously this Media Pulse report is something that you worked on, but what else caught your eye?
So I think in terms of there were two things that really, really interested me. Firstly, there was a dramatic increase in the proportion of readers that felt that Google would have to divest of at least part of its ad tech stack following the DOJ trial. And that was a huge change from before the trial, when the majority thought, nah, they'll probably get away with it, which I think is kind of evidence that Google's lawyers didn't necessarily do the best job during the trial. And I think that's also, you know, testament to the kind of breadth and depth of testimony that the DOJ provided. There were industry experts the world over providing evidence against Google, and they couldn't match that on their side of things. It'll be interesting to see whether that divestment does happen. I believe it's supposed to be during the first couple of quarters this year that we'll get the initial ruling and initial findings from that. So obviously stay tuned on that front. The second interesting finding, again sticking in that kind of legal sphere, we had the exact same proportion saying that the closure of GARM as a result of X's lawsuit against the nonprofit body was a negative, 22%. And we also had 22% saying that it was a positive. And I think that's kind of a real reflection of that contentious nature of the dynamic between media monetization and brand safety. And when you've got, on the one hand, Group M saying that only 1.28% of client ad budget is going towards online news media, and then you obviously read the horrific findings of the latest Adalytics report, it's very clear that that dynamic is something that the industry hasn't quite got right up until this point. Any kind of discussion, debate on how, as an industry, we can bring those two sides together. It's going to be hugely important for the industry going forward.
Yeah, no, absolutely. John, what else jumped out in the report for you when looking at the findings?
Yeah, I can echo those stories from Matt that I thought were incredibly interesting to come out. My personal favourite as Exchange Wire's out of home aficionado, my favourite result was that out of home was deemed the most important area for ad spend over the next year, with 6 in 10 respondents stating that programmatic digital out of home was important within the overall media mix. Love that. Massive surprise. It was a huge upset, to be honest. I really thought CTV was going to walk it. And then no, out of nowhere came out of home to take the top spot, which is nice. Like since the pandemic, out of home's been charting a course upwards, but is, you know, slow in places. I think uptake in terms of understanding of the power of programmatic out of home, how it fits into an omnichannel mix, has been a little bit misunderstood. It's always been seen as brand awareness rather than a functional form of advertising. But yeah, I was really, really pleased to see its importance in the advertising mix and to see it so prominent, to be honest. It was, like I say, it was an upset win for out of home and I loved it.
Amazing. Yeah, no, great figures. And yeah, just great to see the overall positivity in the industry for what's ahead for us all in 2025. Excellent. Well, yeah, I think this is a nice place to wrap up on a positive note. So let's see what's to come for 2025. John, Matt, thank you both for joining me today. And thank you, everybody, for listening. That's it for the MadTech podcast this week. And we look forward to you tuning in next week.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.